Shares of Tesla sank more than 5% on Monday, following a report saying the electric car maker has reached out to some suppliers and asked for its money back. That's according to a report from the Wall Street Journal citing a memo which described the request for refunds as essential to Tesla's continued operation and characterized it as an investment in the car company to continue long-term growth between both parties. One analyst saying, quote, retroactive rebates is not something we hear much about, and this is troubling for us to hear.
Despite the smiles and pleasantries between International Monetary Fund Director Christine Lagarde and her Argentine host at the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires this weekend, she brought words of caution to the party. At a news conference Saturday, she said the recent wave of trade tariffs would significantly harm global growth. In a note to G20 ministers, she said global growth may peak at 3.9% in 2018 and 2019, while downside risks have increased due to the growing trade conflict.
The bankruptcy of Toys R Us hurt Hasbro, pulling down quarterly profit and revenue, but the revenue drop was half of what analysts had forecast. So the toy maker behind Nerf and Star Wars managed to handily beat Wall Street's expectations. Hasbro CEO Brian Goldner said, "We are focused on moving beyond the near-term disruption of losing a major customer." Revenue slid sharply in North America and internationally.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's July 24th, 5:10 in the morning. Here we are with another edition of The Opening Bell. Thank you for being here with us this morning. Another business day getting underway on the broadcast today. Those open workspaces, maybe you're in one this morning, or on your way to one this morning, how are they impacting worker collaboration and human collaboration? There's a new report on that out, and our first guest will have a conversation with us about that. So stay tuned for that. A little bit later in the program, English as a second language, if you hear it or speak it, is it impacting your career path or maybe your business? That'll come in our second segment this morning at about 5:40. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, here are some of the numbers this morning. Futures are pointing toward opening gains a little bit later on Wall Street. Dow futures were up 98 points, good for more than a third. NASDAQ futures are up about a quarter, and S&P futures are up about a quarter as well. Looking around the globe this morning in London, markets are up almost a full percent. In Germany, up more than a percent and a half. And in France, up almost a percent. In Asia, markets in Japan up about a half a percent. The Nikkei is going to end the day probably up about 113 points. The Hang Seng is going to end up about 406 points, almost a percent and a half. And the Shanghai is right there as well, up more than a percent and a half. Oil is trading this morning at $68.27 a barrel, which is up about 38 cents. A couple of stories that we're watching for you this morning. Former prosecutors say a former manager at Equifax has pleaded guilty to insider trading. U.S. Attorney's Office in Atlanta says the former manager pled guilty yesterday to a federal charge of insider trading. Prosecutors say he traded stock options before Equifax publicly announced a massive data breach in the summer of 2017. The U.S. Attorney's Office there says the former manager used his inside knowledge of the breach to make more than $75,000 before the company announced the problem publicly. The 44-year-old was a software development manager at the time for the Atlanta-based credit reporting agency. San Francisco is expected to join Seattle in outlawing plastic straws. The Board of Supervisors takes up that proposal today. The legislation prohibits eateries from using plastic anti-splashers, stirrers, and other plastic items that environmentalists say are too small to be recycled properly. The proposal would kick in next year, makes napkins and utensils on carryout available only on request unless there is some sort of self-serve station. Separately, the legislation would ban vendors from using takeout containers made with fluorinated chemicals starting in January of 2020. Advocates say businesses in progressive San Francisco appear to be largely in support. The American Chemistry Council and Plastic Industry Association are opposed and say the legislation is unnecessary. This is obviously being watched by cities across the country for a possible repeat performance in those cities. front and center this morning. Those open work spaces, how are they impacting human collaboration? You're probably headed to one this morning or at one already. We thought we would discuss this morning with Ethan Bernstein, who is an associate professor of organizational behavior at Harvard School of Business. Ethan, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning.
We have one of these workspaces here at WGN in our new headquarters here that's open. People can share spaces, share offices, work on your laptop at an open table. Is that what we're talking about?
Actually, talking about something very similar. We looked at two corporate headquarters in the United States that were moving from more traditional cubicle offices into open workspaces.
What has the study found here? What has your research found?
So what my co-author, Stephen Turbin, and I were ultimately able to produce, I think, is the first work that looks empirically at how interactions between individuals change when employees move from those traditional cubicles to the really open spaces it sounds like you have right there in the studio.
Are they positive or negative interactions that people are having?
You know, this is why I wanted to do this study. For me, the promise of open offices was at least as compelling as the traps. We hear so much about how people don't like open offices, and yet we hear about how the vibrancy of the environment will just triple or quadruple when you open up the space and data. And what we found actually was the former. So to a degree, we were surprised by the amount of face-to-face interaction when these individuals moved into their open spaces decreased by about 70% in each case, and was replaced by email interaction or IM interaction, online interaction as opposed to face-to-face.
So you said 70%.
70% or wow. So. The two studies were like 67 and 72%.
Is it because, I mean, are people still looking at each other when they're doing this communication, or have they gone and hidden a corner somewhere?
They're still sitting at their desks. The nice thing, we did this using sociometric badges, so these badges people can wear around their necks that will track their face-to-face interactions and then match that with their email and IM communication data. And so we know where they were. We know how they were communicating. We can actually see the interactions in this data that's collected very carefully with our partner, HumanEyes. But what I think this speaks to is that on the one hand, we all imagine these open offices where people will be interacting and colliding with each other and having these innovative and fun conversations. And instead, what we actually get are, you know, you're probably just across the office from me. I can see you, but you're wearing big headphones to stay focused. You're looking really busy because you don't want anyone around you to think you're not busy and everyone can see you now. And I see a guy who's got big headphones on who looks really busy. And I think, well, rather than interrupting him and the 10 people around him, I might as well just send him an email. I know he's at his computer. That's at least one speculation for the mechanism behind the effect that we tracked.
And so what is the impact on the general business climate at a place where this happens? That sounds to me like it's not, hey, I don't like you and I'm not going to talk to you because I have to see you now all of the time. It's more of, hey, we're out in this open space and we're working. But is there an interpersonal problem here with workers?
So here I'm really careful. You know, that we studied two contexts. Every context is going to be different. We were interested in the empirical answer to the question, how do interactions change as a result of a movement to open architecture? In some contexts, this might be really productive. Maybe we actually don't want people talking face-to-face to each other. Maybe online they're getting more work done and having better collaborations. We don't have an implicit assumption that this is good or bad. In these two contexts, however, these organizations were intending to boost face-to-face interactions and had some unintended consequences as a result of moving more and more open. And so that's the cautionary tale we have here.
And the cautionary tale, I would imagine there might be some managers listening to this conversation this morning, is what moving forward here? I'm guessing you'd like to study those other things and see if there are those other issues. But what is the takeaway for managers who might be thinking about moving to this space? I'm guessing they should look at it a little bit more closely.
I think that's right. If anything, we'd like to throw a bucket of ice water on the idea that there's no trade-off in going to the open spaces. Mind you, many companies just go to it because it's a lower cost per square foot. But accompanying that justification has been this idea that you'll get more collaboration, at least more face-to-face collaboration as a result. And at the very least, two very typical headquarters, corporate headquarters context in the United States, that wasn't at all true. The reverse was true. And they suffered the consequences of that, hopefully so others don't have to.
Ethan, hang on with us. We're going to continue our conversation this morning with Ethan Bernstein. He's the Associated Professor of Organizational Behavior at the Harvard School of Business. We're talking about the impact of open office workspace on human collaboration. The research shows that face-to-face interaction decreased by about 70% in the cases that they studied where people are working in these open spaces. Ethan, I'm curious, I know that this study went on for a while, but is this something that we're just not used to and that maybe workers will get better accustomed to and this might, what your findings have shown might change?
We were very careful to try and do this study in such a way that we would not capture that effect, that we would capture the real effect of people working. So we looked at time periods where that would be the case. We waited long enough for people to adjust. We even tried to capture time periods pre and post such that they were at the same seasonal cycle of these businesses so that we weren't trying to get, we weren't getting other noise in the study as well. So in this case, as much as I'm not a fan or an opponent of the open office, but as much as I would like to say to you, yes, it was just the way the study was conducted, I think we were pretty careful on this one.
You know, earlier I asked you what the takeaway here is for managers who might be considering this, but I'm wondering, in the two cases that you studied here, in the cases that you studied, have they changed their layout? Have they changed the way that the workers are facing each other? Or are they gone back to the cubicles? What's changed?
At least one of the contexts has actually taken a step back. They're doing what many other organizations now are thinking about doing, more flexible spaces, more team-oriented spaces, making sure they build boundaries back in. The other thing that I can add to that, I've had some interesting conversations with managers and executives since the study came out. And one organization that's known for its open office environments in the technology sector actually had a couple of managers sitting with me, one of whom said, "We don't have this problem. This isn't us. We have these open offices and they work great." And the gentleman sitting next to him literally said, "Well, actually, if you took a lot of time to look and listen, you'd discover all of the real noise, i.e. all of the interaction, is actually coming from behind the team-oriented meeting room doors." And so I do think that at least that is some hint of how organizations might be willing to deal with this.
You know, there's all of these new co-working spaces that have developed. I'm thinking of WeWork specifically. It has locations here in Chicago, these places where people can go who may not have, an office anyway to go work at. And these places seem to be thriving, at least that's what they tell us. What does the impact of this study have on businesses like those that are pushing forward these working spaces?
The organizations I would hope this study speaks to most are big organizations, organizations where all the people are working for one company. I can't speak to nearly as much with this data the question of how do we work together when we're in one co-located space, but we're very different individuals working for different organizations. We're doing different things. So, the desire of people to work in Starbucks with people who look like themselves but are doing different jobs at different organizations, the whole office movement where you join other people at their home, working different jobs but together in one space, these are different in the sense that you wouldn't necessarily be communicating with these individuals for work purposes anyway. So I wouldn't want to necessarily say that the results here translate to the environments there. Does that make sense?
It does, yes. I wanted to ask you a question because you touched on it just then, the alternatives to these open spaces that you studied. You mentioned a few there, but what would be some of the other alternatives, do you think?
Oh, anything with walls. we've taken such an extreme step towards openness that we're having this conversation. We wouldn't have been having this conversation necessarily 20 years ago. But now that the idea is everyone needs as big of an audience as possible for the work that they're doing, I think that's the context in which this applies. And so any answer where you start to think about the ways in which you bound off smaller groups of individuals, not going back to the individual offices necessarily, because those have downsides too. But these wide open expanses don't necessarily lend themselves, again, to the kind of interaction or collaboration that they're intended to create.
Right, and even aside from the collaboration, I know I've read some stories recently about, and again, in the wake of the Me Too movement and other other issues like that, just to have the private space. You know, you may not be having a good day when you come to work, and you don't want to sit in front of everybody and have them staring at you.
And I've done a lot of research, both this and other research, on the idea that group privacy, not individual privacy necessarily at work, not no privacy, but group-level privacy might actually be what team-oriented workplaces need most. So again, that's at least my speculation, but I don't have, at least in this study, the opportunity to say, and we tried this and it worked.
Right.
That's a subject I leave to those architects and managers listening out there.
Yeah, and then the other, you know, we'll end on this, I guess, the bottom line here. If workers don't feel comfortable in these places, they're going to end up leaving, and that's not going to be good for a company.
Well, that's true, too. We didn't have people leaving in this case. We had people just not talking as much to each other face-to-face. Maybe the broader way to think of that is we all spend time as managers and as employees being observed and observing others. We tend to these days design workspaces for those who are observing, not for those who are being observed. But it's those who are being observed who get most of the work done. So, yeah, if they're going to not collaborate, not communicate, not interact, or perhaps leave, as you point out, maybe we need to start thinking a little bit more about that.
Ethan, thank you for plenty to think about this morning, and we appreciate you being here with us on the program.
It's great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Ethan Bernstein is an associate professor of organizational behavior at Harvard School of Business, the impact of open workspaces on human collaboration. We're going to link out to the study when we post the podcast of the program later this morning at WGNRadio.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. When English is a second language to either speakers, listeners, or both, what are the impacts on communication? What are the impacts, let's say, on life, business, maybe even career advancement? Guillaume Thierry is professor of cognitive neuroscience at Bangor University in Wales, is with us this morning to have a conversation about this. Guillaume, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning, Steve.
Let's start first by talking about English. Let's put a new term on folks if they've not heard this. Lingua franca status. What does that mean?
Oh, well, it's pretty simple. It means that English has achieved prime status. It's basically the language that's used to talk about business, but not just business, politics, science. Any general business in the world is mostly discussed in English today.
101 countries, I think, is the current total. But some people have trouble communicating, even in English. What are the problems, the trouble with speaking English as a second language?
Well, it's not so much the problem of speaking English as a second language that is a tricky situation. It's actually the reverse. It's the fact that people who speak English as their first language and live in a world that's mostly speaking English as a second language, they have a problem interfacing with the world. So the problem is, from the listener's point of view, if you're using English as a second language, you, of course, have decreased comprehension, and you can't communicate everything you would like to. I'm myself French originally, and I speak English as my second language, and I've discovered that there are things that I can't express in English, or things that I've discovered that are new and I can't express back in French. And so the problem is, for the second language speaker, a problem of limitation. But the problem for the first language speaker is that they never discover fully the state of mind or the conceptions of the person speaking in their second language. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And that seems like a pretty big wall that separates us.
It is. And what is interesting, I think, is that people underestimate the vulnerabilities of having a lingua franca as their first language. I mean, I'm just going to give you an image to make that a bit simpler. It would be a piece of cake, very easy for anyone in Russia or in Africa or in China to come and navigate the networks of languages in the US and in the UK, for instance, because they kind of know English and they can find their way through. But for the English-speaking world, which has got very low proficiency in other languages, it will be simply impossible to penetrate the meanders of networks of China, Russia, or Africa, simply because you don't know the language. So there is a vulnerability here that's been underestimated and that may be causing serious problems in the future, actually.
Let's talk about that. In the opening, in introducing you, I talked about business and career advancement in a world that is becoming now global, a global world of business. From that perspective alone, I'm thinking of lots of different problems that could exist.
There are a huge number of problems. People assume that because English is the lingua franca, they can just go anywhere and speak with anyone and assume that understanding is mutual. The problem is that if you speak only English and you don't have any understanding of the language of your interlocutor, you have no chance of understanding their culture and their expectations. And fine-tuning an agreement will require you to understand exactly where they come from, what they want, what their state of mind is, what their goal is. And to do that without knowing their language is simply impossible.
So what is the solution here? Obviously, it's learning another language, and I know some businesses require their employees when they go global to learn other languages. Is that really the number one solution here?
Absolutely. There's absolutely no question about this. And the problem is that learning another language is a difficult thing. Let's be clear. Nobody would argue that it's a simple thing. But if you learn another language, you're gaining much more than just a tool. You're gaining a new perspective on the world, a new access to information that you could never dream of gathering any other way. Basically, it's as if you had a second, you know, a new pair of glasses that enables you to see much further or even in a different dimension. And people think that this is kind of like science fiction or an overstatement, but it's absolutely true. In our research, we find everyday effects of the foreign language that are deep and powerful and far more extensive than people assume.
Is it too much to say that this could eventually be also a matter of life and death?
I would think that anything that's a matter of global diplomacy, you know, languages and words can start war. So if there is misunderstanding between people talking and if they don't actually talk the same language, in the sense, not that's actually a problem with this expression, talking the same language, speaking the same language, because actually what you need to do is to speak the language of the other, meaning that a fully meaningful conversation is a bilingual conversation, a conversation between two people who understand each other's languages. This is not the common ground right now. The common ground is you assume that if you speak English, everybody understands everything. That actually is a complete it's misrepresented.
Right, and you, what you're saying is if you have learned a second language or another language, you know that certain things mean certain things differently. It can be have different meanings in different languages. That's, I'm guessing, what you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, and especially when it comes to cultural stereotypes and you know, expectations or ideology, if you don't have an understanding of the other's state of mind, how can you come to a perfect agreement? That's the problem. I mean, this is commonly seen as if you want, linguistic relativity, the idea that different languages handle representations of the world right down to perception differently. And so if you don't have an understanding, if you don't have a mastery of the other language, you cannot actually perceive everything that the other person perceives. The only way is to get knowledge of that language.
And we're having a global conversation, I think, but especially here in the United States, about truth. If you don't understand the language, it's sometimes hard to come to agreement on the truth, isn't it?
And that's true. And there are some people who would argue that monolingualism is fine because if everybody speaks the same language, say English, you know, we'll come to an agreement on what's true and what's not. Except that language doesn't carry, you know, languages carry with them a whole host of representations and meaning that is only specific to that language. And if you don't learn the other language, you don't get a chance to access this. So there is no universal truth unless there is a universal sharing of languages, and I mean the plural here very seriously, not just one language, but several languages that actually coexist.
Guillaume, I mentioned earlier that a solution to this, and you confirmed it, is learning another language. I've often heard that as you get older, it's harder to learn another language. Is it harder and or impossible? And what would be the struggle there?
That's a very good question. And Steve, and to be honest, I've got my own opinion that's forged over years about this. I think this is a complete myth. I think people can learn languages later in life without any particular problem. The issue here is the amount of time you devote to it. When you're a baby, you have no other time to devote to any other thing. You just want to learn language and make sense of the world around you. So it happens because you have fast, because you have this kind of devotion to it. But if you are older, you have lots of other things happening. You have a job, you have other activities that compete with the idea of learning language. But if I drop you in the middle of Japan tomorrow for 3 weeks and you have no means of accessing English, I can assure you that by the end of 3 weeks, you'll be almost fluent in Japanese.
Those immersive programs, I remember when I was in high school and learning French and Spanish, the big thing there was actually going to those countries. We did in both of
Absolutely.
Those classes and immersing ourselves. Guillaume, we appreciate you being with us this morning. Thank you for the information.
You are very welcome.
Guillaume Thierry, a professor of cognitive neuroscience at Bangor University in Wales. And we'll post out a link as well to some of what we've been talking about here with this in the podcast of The Opening Bell later this morning at WGNradio.com.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market, Dow Jones futures are up 76 points. That's good for third. NASDAQ and S&P futures are also higher this morning. Let's get an update on agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. The Department of Agriculture issued its weekly crop progress report yesterday afternoon. Didn't show much change. It showed the good to excellent condition rating steady for corn, and it raised it by 1 percentage point for soybeans. An interesting side story on soybeans, however. The top good to excellent state in the Midwest, Wisconsin. 81% of the soybean crop in America's dairyland, good to excellent. Illinois, 78%. Indiana, 68%. And Iowa, 76%. Soybeans, good to excellent. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Tuesday, July 24th, on the calendar today, we'll get a look at House Price Index from the FHFA. Also, the Richmond Fed Manufacturing Index is due. It's a big day for earnings from 3M, AT&T, Harley-Davidson, JetBlue, Kimberly-Clark, Lockheed Martin, Texas Instruments, and Verizon. Just some of the things that could move the markets today on this Tuesday, July the 24th.